I got to say, for me personally, to you, congratulations on the success that your latest album, 100% Fun, has had.
Thanks. Thanks very much.
I know you've been working really, really hard, and it was just really cool to see how that that album has done so well for you. It's definitely your bestseller, right?
Well, it's gold already. It went gold a couple weeks ago, and which I guess means it took like 7 months or something to go gold. And Girlfriend just went gold this spring.
Oh, great.
So that took 3.5 years.
There you go.
You know, so I guess time will tell, you know, which one sells more. But I guess it's fast catching up with Girlfriend. I imagine Girlfriend might just be a few units ahead still. But
I just excuse me. I just love this story. For those that have never heard the story of the cover artwork, there's a photo on Matthew's album Girlfriend that he just referred to. Tell the true life story about who this is, and then how it came to appear on the Girlfriend album. I love this story.
I'll explain why I have a lot of guilt when you bring this up.
Oh no!
Well, it's a picture of Tuesday Weld, who, for people that don't know who she is, she's an actress who was kind of became popular as a teen actress in the late 50s. She was on Dobie Gillis and in some really early rock movies. There's one called Rock Rock Rock. I think was her first movie. And I got into collecting some memorabilia, mostly on an actress named Jean Seberg, who is from Iowa. I have like a really big collection of Seberg stuff. My wife and I kind of got into collecting it together. And while we were looking for stuff on Seberg, I picked up some photographs of Tuesday Weld, including that one that's on the cover of Girlfriend, which is, I think she's about 14 years old.
Wow.
Looking like she's, you know, 35 or something.
Wow.
And I always really liked that photo, and I really wanted to use it for the cover of Girlfriend. And when we finally got a deal for the record, we started working on getting it, and we had to go through a lot of stages of having her approve all the lyrics and approve the photo and everything.
Wait a minute. Wait a second. Just to use this photo, Ms. Weld wanted to know all about how were you going to use this. In other words, not just how you're going to use it, but what it was going to represent.
Yeah, I think so. And you know, at that point, the album was also called Nothing Lasts.
Oh.
And what happened was we got approval to use the photo, and then right at the last minute, her management got really upset and threatened to not let us use the photo because they found out it was called Nothing Lasts, and they thought it was like reflected poorly on her, you know. And rather than give up, I'd fought so hard to get that photo. Rather than give it up, I changed the title to Girlfriend.
Good move, good
which
call,
I think was a
Matthew.
Good move too. Yeah, I like that title. And so there are actually even early advanced copies of that record around that say Nothing Lasts.
Oh,
I mean,
wait a
cassettes
minute.
Of it anyway.
Really?
But the reason I said I was felt guilty about it is early this summer, I actually got a message from Tuesday Weld to call her. And I haven't done it yet. Like, I still have her number. And I think it has something to do with her son. I think was moving out to L.A. and looking to get in the music business or something like that. But she, you know, it took me two and a half years to get an autograph on that picture from her, you know, through her management, because she won't sign stuff. She has a really weird thing about it. And it was just like Tuesday Weld scrawled on it, like no personalization or anything when I finally got it, you know. So I couldn't believe it when I heard, you know, she actually wanted to talk to me. And I keep saying, I'm going to do it today. And I guess I just am kind of nervous, like what it'll be like talking to her.
I was about to say, I was going to play the part of your analyst and say, now, Matthew, let's look into this. Why have you not called her back?
I don't know. I can't quite figure it out. Something in my past. So I'm going to do it, though. I'm going to be home finally. I haven't been home for one thing. I've been traveling. Last time I was home was in June for 10 days.
Wait a minute. It's mid-October.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Let's take a listen to the album that's got this story behind the cover. This is the song Girlfriend, Matthew Sweet.
I Cause you need to get back in the arms of a good friend. And I need to get back in the arms of a girlfriend. I didn't know. You need to get back in the arms of a good friend. Oh, 'cause honey, believe me, she loved to call you my girlfriend. You need to get back in the arms of a good friend. Oh, 'cause honey, believe me, she loved to call you my girlfriend. Cause you got a good thing going, baby. You only need somebody to love. Well, you got a good thing going. Looking for someone to love, 'cause you need to get back in the arms of a good friend.
That's Matthew Sweet and Girlfriend from the album of the same name. Originally, the album was going to be called what now?
Nothing Lasts.
And did it ever actually make it to the streets or any covers with that? Because I was going to. I like to collect stuff.
There's
like
not
that.
A cover with the Tuesday Weld photo with it. I mean, unless artwork existed, I kind of don't think so. But there are advanced cassettes that have that title.
I'm going to have to dig around for that. I love stuff like that.
If I'm not mistaken, that cassette would have a artwork from drawings from the Cobra comic, which is Space Adventure Cobra, is a Japanese animated movie that we took the footage for the Girlfriend video from. And the artist that did that, they published, you know, comic books of him as well. And I believe there's a drawing from that comic on that cassette that would have the title.
It's interesting, when talking with you, Matthew Sweet, it's interesting that as often as music comes up, things like classic films and comic books and things like that come up too. Are you a film buff or a particular kind of film buff or a comic book buff?
Yeah, I mean, I would say as far as comics go, I'm not very well-rounded. You know, I know about a little bit, but it's kind of been specific things, mostly Japanese comics that I got into.
Now, how did you get into that?
I just liked the style of drawing. You know, it looked like something from Mars to me or something. And at the time I got into it, it was really hard to find a lot of the stuff, whereas now it's really exploded, you know, since then, and a lot of stuff is available. It was just sort of like a challenge to find things, and I just was enamored with the style of artwork. I'm really into movies, to answer your question, you know, all different kinds. You know, I was a big fan of, you know, teen movies growing up, from, you know, sort of Fast Times at Ridgemont High kind of stuff I'm really into. But also horror movies, you know, I'm kind of into that genre, and really all kinds of things. I like movies in general, really fascinate me. If I was going to have another career, I would probably get involved in film somehow, more likely on the kind of directing, producing side.
No kidding. We're talking with Matthew Sweet. So, but that's something that possibly having a successful rock music career might be an entree into that?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I don't know. Sometimes I think, you know, when I think of it in those terms, I think, oh, you know, stick with what, you know, you're good at or whatever. But on the other hand, you know, I have certain dreams about it, and I would like to at least, you know, experiment with it sometime. But I don't know if the two things could be connected too much. I mean, I guess I kind of feel like I would really have to feel like I could take a couple of years off from music and really focus on doing something in film. And it's, you know, the stakes are so much higher financially than making records even, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm sure it's something, you know, not to be taken lightly as far as trying to do it right.
Well, you know? Just make sure you do it with OPM, other people's money.
Yeah, well, obviously.
Yeah. We're talking with Matthew Sweet live on Q102. Matthew Sweet's in concert tonight. Is making music videos an opportunity to kind of bridge
that gap? Yeah. Not as much as you'd think it could be, or I would hope it would.
Why is
I mean, that I think because it just is such a commercial venture, it costs a lot of money, so there's a lot of pressure from the labels. It's very, very hard to get videos played that break the mold, you know, that try something really different. In my experience, you know, I've certainly spent a lot of time making videos trying to make them different and weird or whatever, you know. I mean, not trying to make them weird, but making videos that are considered weird, you know. And my experience with it is just that there are, you know, roadblocks every step of the way. Now, I'm a person who believes that, yes, eventually, you know, rock videos or whatever will have got to get more in the hands of the artists and become more of a personal expression. And I think you would find if you asked a lot of different artists about it that almost everybody would agree with me that it's real hard to have it be that at this stage.
Can I butt in for a second?
Uh-huh.
I got to say that I think most of us on this side of the video screen assume that a large part of it or all of it every time we see a music video is the musician's vision. And you're saying here categorically that that's rarely the case?
Well, I mean, in my case, maybe, you know, I've gotten really involved with directors I've worked with and really tried to be in there in the creative process. But I think in general, when videos are made, a director who's a video director is hired because of a treatment he makes. And I mean, just in my experience, people I know in bands that have to do videos, you know, usually it's like a somewhat nightmarish, you know, experience where you don't get exactly what you want. There's just so many people involved. It costs so much money. The money is spent very, very quickly. It's usually in one day. And, you know, you can easily spend, and I make, you know, of the lower scale of money spent on videos, you know, it's easy to spend $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 in one day.
And
probably much more typical to spend, you know, for a lot of bigger artists to spend, you know, $200,000 or $300,000, which, you know, you can make an album for easily.
Several.
So there's a lot of pressure about it. And the real problem is there's nowhere for videos that are different to get played. You know, I mean, everything, you know, with MTV kind of ruling everything and all the market research they do, they want videos that are just show the artist playing the song, you know, whereas I'm much more interested in, you know, not being in my videos. Although over time I've just, you know, ended up kind of giving in to doing it. And instead I try to think of creative ways that I can be in it and be able to stand it like myself, you know? And so, I mean, I don't know. I think maybe if I sold millions of records, I'd find I had more power kind of to change that. But like I said, the problem is really where is there an outlet to play things that are different, you know? And I think until there are more channels that are real forces nationally that play videos, it's going to be hard to do that. There's just such limited space, and it's very much governed by how well things are doing at radio. You know, there's not really an alternative video format that really gets exposed. I mean, there are local video shows that maybe, you know, take more chances and play videos that MTV doesn't necessarily play or embrace, but you still don't have a way to get to the masses with things that are different very easily, you know. And I've just found in my experience that there's not a very open mind to being different, you know.
Well, I think a single outlet channel, if there was a single national newspaper or a single national radio station or something, that too would wield that kind of clout. Yeah. Let me ask you.
I'm kind of surprised there haven't been alternative channels that have popped up.
I'm just going to ask you. You sound like you're very well versed and know the facts of how this. And the, it begs the obvious question then. If MTV is so profitable, and I mean, that stuff is public record, you can look at the end of the year and see that it is very profitable, why haven't other national or regional video music channels popped up of the scope of an MTV to compete with it and maybe take some of that subjectiveness out of it?
My guess is that just a massive amount of money must go into getting, you know, all those, the cable rights or whatever to have a channel like that. I mean, we've heard about it even so many times, even from MTV, that they're supposed to split into three or four channels, which would allow them to show more videos and different genres and everything, but it's just never
VH1
happened.
VH1 is the only thing really that was spawned, right?
Yeah. And I mean, VH1 has, you know, for instance, VH1 played We're the Same, my last video, a lot more than MTV did, you know.
Really?
I'm glad for, and I mean, don't get me wrong, MTV's been relatively, you know, supportive of me, and it's, you know, I have a kind of mixed feelings about it. Like, on the one hand, I'm thankful for what they've given me, but it's still, I'm still frustrated that there aren't more outlets for it. But I don't really know, you know, it's an interesting question. I'm sure there's a few people that could lecture us
on
it.
Well, it'd be neat to have Joey Ramone sitting next to you on the microphone and have him tell his situation and his experience with MTV as far as the Ramones. And I mean, it's absolutely criminal how the Ramones have been treated with their own work and what they've spawned. You know, with Green Day and The Offspring and just tons of
that. And, you know, the other problem, you know, while we're, you know, discussing MTV.
No, actually, I'm not dissing anybody, are you.
I hear you.
It's an interesting subject.
You know, it is a business, and I think that's also part of the problem is the whole mentality about it, even at the labels as well, is that, you know, listen, these videos aren't art, they're an advertisement for a record, you know, and that's how they look at it. And so they want a video that's gonna get shown for sure, you know, and that kind of mentality always breeds, you know, conformity. Now, in MTV's defense also, I think over time, less and less of their programming has been devoted to videos. And I think part of the reason for that is they found that research about, you know, people's habits of watching MTV, that if they had a show on that's a half-hour show, you know, I think before they had a lot of programming of shows on that channel, people would tune in and watch for a minute or two, and then when a video came on they didn't like, they'd switch channels again. And then they realized, well, if you have a show that's a half hour long, if you snag somebody with it, they're there for a half hour. You know, I think it was really hard for MTV to get ratings in the common, you know, Nielsen format or whatever, because people would never watch it more than a couple minutes at a time. Even if they watched it a lot, they're never coming long enough to register, you know, in the Nielsen boxes. And so so that's another thing that's happened, to where, you know, they have a big problem too, which is, you know, millions of labels and acts and videos being thrown at them every week and just a very limited amount of time to program videos. You know, so that's a problem as well. And once again, it makes you wonder, why aren't there more channels, you know?
Yeah, it's a good question. I wish I had the answer. We're talking with Matthew Sweet live in the Q102 Out of Control Room. I'm Redbeard. Matthew, in concert tonight. We're going to play this next song that I'm told is probably your biggest song to date. And then I want to ask you about a quote I read about from your songwriting perspective. I want to ask you about Sick of Myself. We'll find out. Is he? On Q102.
I'm out of luck. choice to leave you. I'll throw away a chance at greatness just to make this dream come into play.
Matthew Sweet, that's Sick of Myself from the album 100% Fun. Matthew Sweet's in the Out of Control Room with us here live on Q102. You sounded like you had a ball making that song.
Oh, that was fun, yeah. Well, you know, we didn't know we were making a record when we cut the basic track
what?
For it.
Really?
It was what happened is I wrote that song right before I went in to record, and we'd already picked all the songs for the record, and I hadn't even really quite finished the lyrics, although I had a lot of, you know, the main chorus and everything, and the drums were all sounding so great on our basic tracks, and Brendan, the producer, couldn't be there one night, and Rick Mink, who played drums on this song, was still in town, and I asked Brendan if I could just record some drums that night just to use so I could make a home demo with these great sounding drums like later on. And he came in and checked in on us, and we were in the middle of, I think that's about our second take of it.
Wow.
And he said, "Hey, I hope you've got some, you know, melody and words for that." and I said, "Sure." And so we kind of finished it off. And I think it really has that free feeling quality because we just didn't care, you know, when we were doing it. We didn't know it was a record. And for extra endings on the end of it, when we were coming around on the first proper ending, Rick, I guess, went one too many times. Like, he didn't stop with me. And so I kept waving to him to do it again because I was looking to get an edit piece to cut on to the end of it to have the proper number of times around, you know. And when we went in and listened to it before we edited it together, it sounded like, you know, a band going ahead and playing again and again, you know. And so I just overdubbed the instruments along with it, you know. And so it became this false ending thing. It really was totally by mistake.
You know? Yeah. It's definitely, I think, been your most played song.
Yeah, I think that's true. We've had the biggest radio all around. Yeah.
All around. Now, I was reading, someone did an interview with you in the print media recently, and they were asking you about, you know, having your biggest hit song so far in your career from the album 100% Fun. And your response was something like, you know, as a songwriter, somebody once told me that when you write the dumbest song you ever write, be prepared because that'll
be the big hit. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, Sick of Myself is you know, I've often said that in reference to Girlfriend more so than Sick of Myself, which is a little bit more complex song, you know, as far as what's going on in it. than girlfriend is. But that was something, I think it was actually Jules Shear said that to me, but there were other people real early on when I was making my first records. He said, you know, if you have a big hit, it'll always be something that's like totally not like what you're good at, or it'll just be some oddball thing, you know. And it was very much that way with Girlfriend. Although Sick of Myself, yeah, again, I would say it doesn't exactly fit into the total throwaway category. And I mean, Girlfriend, I think, is a fun record and I like it, but it was really an exercise where I didn't have a song to record that day, and I played the drums first, like all those crazy start and stop things, and just did this three chord thing with it and kind of sang over the top. And it just had this thing about it that people, like my friends and stuff, were like, hey, that's cool, you know, I like that. And I remember Lloyd Cole in particular, who I was doing some playing with around that time, really said, that song, you know. And my manager, Russell, who had been my lawyer for years and took over as my manager right around the Girlfriend time, really deserves a lot of credit for sticking with that song as well. So, you know, I don't mean to put it down. I'm sort of being sarcastic, you know, when I say that, but it's sort of true as well, you know.
I picked up from what you said. It's just one of those songs, in other words, it'll follow you,
yeah.
And it'll follow you.
And with Sick of Myself, it's always like, you know, are you sick of yourself, Matthew? You know, why so sick of yourself? And I'm always saying, you know, I'm my own best friend. It's not really like me, you know.
Oh, that's great.
But I did think it was funny starting the record, you know, 100% fun with Sick of Myself.
Sure. We're talking with Matthew Sweet at Q102. Now, we talked about the Girlfriend cover. I just love... There's this photo on the front of the current Matthew Sweet album, 100% Fun. And, I mean, this young man. I mean,
pre-rock in that photo.
Okay. You're sitting there. How old are you there?
I'm 10 years old.
10, and you're
1974.
Wearing... 1974. And you're wearing...
Dates me there.
You're wearing headphones, and you've got an album...
Giant headphones.
Yeah, and you've got an album in your lap, and you've got this huge... I mean, Robert Redford grin, you know? And
people used to tell me I looked like Donny Osmond about that time.
You know, you did. There's a little Donny Osmond in there.
A little bit of that smile.
We've
got a Donny and Marie t-shirt we have out, actually, for Sick of Myself, where they're, like, singing the lyrics to each other. That's pretty funny. I'm listening to my King Kong album. That's why I'm so happy. I was into monster movies, really big. At that age, and I would read a magazine called Famous Monsters of Filmland all the time, and you know, make up half my face like a skeleton and everything,
wow.
You know. And I think I ordered that record mail order out of that magazine, if I'm not mistaken. And I've met somebody, I don't have it still, but I've met somebody, a couple people who still have it during the touring this year, and somebody told me they were like radio plays that were recycled as children's records. So yeah. I'm there with my King Kong album. Yeah. I thought there was kind of an amusing phallic symbol happening with the, if you look at its placement on the cover, but nobody ever really picks up on it.
I missed it.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Keep looking, you know.
It was lost on me. But I tell you what I did pick up on. I mean, you've got this fabulous just grin on your face. You're wearing these headphones. But the rest of it is like... pure Americana, the background.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's Nebraska, 1974. That's my dad's den. My dad's a, he's kind of involved in restaurants now, but he was a lawyer. And so that was like his law den, sort of, you know, where I'd have to go to use the record player.
It's got the plaid, early American furniture, you know, stuffed the thing. It's got the walnut end table.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and the reading lamp, you know.
There's
just
sort of American Indian... art paintings on the walls.
It's just like, you know, I mean, it just oozes Americana with this 10-year-old kid,
yeah,
grinning.
It's kind of specific. Well, the other thing is, you know, they bugged me for years to put just be on the cover of my, you know, my early records. I'm on the cover of, but they're always like blurry photos and stuff like that. I guess not my very first one, but you know, in recent years they're always trying to get me to put myself on the covers. You know, since Girlfriend, and I always resisted. And I saw that photo and I kind of thought, now there's a big smiling photo of me that I'll put on the cover.
Yeah. But
and of course, then they thought it was really weird and specifically like, are you sure you want to use this? I'm like, yes, I'm sure. I wanted it to have a real personal feeling about it. But, you know, obviously I couldn't put another, you know, actress photo on it or something I wanted to look at. So I went for something with me.
You know, I think it's saying something about you as a person, not even more than as a musician. You've already admitted that you really have hesitated to put your physical image in your videos, and only really did so in certain ways. And now you've mentioned that you've really hesitated and tried not to get your physical countenance on your album covers. Now, after these three albums, stuff like that, I'm sure there's a lot of pressure from the record companies, like, Matthew, we need to develop an image. You know, we got to get that big toothy smile.
I mean,
you know,
it was a real hard thing for me when I first signed with CBS, and they said, they really said, we think you should be a singer songwriter, use your real name. You know, be a, you know, at the time I was, you know, going under different band names and things, and I guess I always just felt like just being a guy and playing. It was just so, we've seen it all before. I just thought it was kind of inherently boring. You know. And I just envisioned, like, somehow I could make it more interesting by not having it just be me, this guy, you know? And in a way, the way I've ended up doing that is by getting a lot of my hobbies and these kind of pop culture things into my videos and my artwork and all of that. And I've really exploited things I'm into, from, you know, from Japanese animation to, you know, my 1970 Challenger during the whole Altered Beast era. And, oh, thank you. Oh, I'm looking forward to picking it up. I haven't driven
in a
long time.
Oh, okay. I'll hold that thought. We got to come back to that.
Yeah, we can talk about the Challenger. I've got kind of a cool story to tell about that. But, you know, those kinds of things. And, like, I was hugely into Beyond the Valley of the Dolls this year, watching that video all the time. So the We're the Same video is kind of, you know, very loosely kind of a takeoff of that. And so, you know, that's the way I've done it. And, you know, it's hard because, you know, the fans, like, do want to see what you look like and all that, you know. So I've tried to be, you know, somewhat understanding about it and get in things somewhat. You know, the Sick of Myself video, I'm really in a lot, you know. And even that, they kind of don't think I was really in it as much as they want, but I don't know what they want from me.
You know, it's interesting. There are a few, not a lot, but there are a few other musicians with popular, you know, careers and things like that that I've interviewed and talked to that share your reticence for putting the spotlight physically on them on album covers and in videos. And it's interesting. It seems to me that some really bright, very intellectual musicians that I've interviewed share your same feeling. They feel that in the long run, not to be too narcissistic about this whole thing.
Yeah. Well, I was never that kind of person. Like, I got into doing music because I felt a real strong affinity for music. I really learned how to do it and got into it hiding out literally, like, in my bedroom, you know, making multi-track tapes that I was, you know, couldn't sit in a room and play for someone and be there and hear it, you know. And so, I mean, I've come a long way in that respect. I mean, at this point, you know, I've really almost turned around to the point where I can be comfortable getting in the spotlight or whatever. But it was part of my personality always to be a little more shy about things. And I mean, I guess I felt like that was more true to me to do things a little bit differently. And
well, it fits in perfect with Japanese comics. And
yeah, that's true. That's a real Altered Beast kind of track, actually. Yeah.
You mentioned the Altered Beast album, but the title had a real life monster, and it had nothing to do with comic books. What's the real Altered Beast in your life?
Well, what are we talking about? The Challenger
here?
Yeah,
the car. Come on. What else
is
there?
It comes from the video game Altered Beast.
You know, it's girls and cars and rock and roll.
Yeah, well, you know, I got this 1970 Challenger, I guess, right after Girlfriend, while I was making Altered Beast. And it's, you know, got a 440 Magnum in it, and it's, you know, kind of hot rodded out. And the color is plum crazy, which is purple metallic. It was called Plum Crazy.
Yes, it was.
And you know, some people are like, yeah, tell us something we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the fun thing about my car is that early this spring I did a show for VH1 called Naked Cafe, which is sort of like an artist's hobby show. And they said, you know, we want to take you down to meet this guy who designed the Batmobile. His name's George Barris.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
And at the time, I didn't really know too much about Barris.
Well, see, I'm old enough to remember.
Yeah, see,
when I was the age that you are on the cover of this album, I was reading all the, all the magazines about customizing cars, and George Barris.
Yeah, he's like the king of custom cars.
And,
well, so I said, oh, cool, the Batmobile, whatever, you know. So they had me bring my Challenger down there to meet him, and And sitting outside of his shop there when I first met him was a exact replica of the Spider that James Dean was driving that he was killed in. And so the first thing I asked Barris, I said, oh, what's this, you know, doing here? And well, it turns out, you know, Barris put James Dean in, you know, customized his car in the 50s and put him in his car the day he died, you know, saw him off. In fact, it was one of Barris's guys that was with him in the car, I believe, who lived through that accident. And as I was there with him doing this interview with the VH1 people, it slowly started to become clear that this guy had done just like everything, every cool car you've ever seen in any movie or TV show. I mean, just everything. I mean, he did, you know, painted Lennon's Rolls Royce Paisley and put the speakers under the wheel covers for him, you know. He, you know, did Elvis's first custom tour bus, which I believe is one of the first, like, real tour buses made. You know, Priscilla stayed with him and his wife, like, when she first came out to L.A. When she was still a teenager, you know, after Elvis got back from the war, and on, you know, just every TV show and movie, you know. So I was just completely blown away by this guy who was also just an incredible sweetheart, you know, just the nicest guy. And he offered to sort of take my car under his wing and, you know.
Stop a second.
Yeah?
You gave your 1970 Plum Crazy Challenger to George Barris?
That's right. And he took it to have a lot of the mechanical work done to a place called Solo Performance in L.A., which does, like, all of, like, Leno's cars and Schwarzenegger. You know, Leno has a huge car collection.
Collectors.
And they've been, you know, like, recovering the dashboard for me. That was kind of the most major thing I needed to have done to it. There were huge cracks and, you know, kind of fissures in the in the dashboard of it. So it's got a newly recovered dashboard. Every, you know, all the engines been finely tuned. They basically, you know, tightened all the screws and you know, put silicone in to stop all the rattles and everything. It's just going to be, like, perfectly cherried out.
You should see the grin on his face.
It's just because I'm going to get it in another 10 days. It's going to be more perfect than it's ever been.
Let me tell you something. There's something that happens when you pick up a car like that that's your baby.
Yeah, sure.
You go.
And I've been through a lot with it. I've worked on it a lot. And
how long you had it now?
Oh, God. It's going on, I guess, 3 years. Mm-hmm. Something like that.
What happens is when you pick it up, you get into this euphoria because you're so glad to get it back, and they hand you this bill that's the size of the Dallas-Fort Worth phone book.
This is the amazing thing about it that makes me so happy.
And you don't care at the time because you got your car back.
No, the thing is that I kept telling Barris, listen, I can't afford to do, like, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars of work. He's like, listen, I make all my money in movies and stuff. You know, we just love, you know, people who love cars, and we just do this for fun, and don't worry, it's not going to be much. And I swear, they've had my car since May and done so much stuff to it. My bill is like $900 for it.
You're kidding
so
me.
If you know anything about muscle cars and what the bills can be like, which is what you're saying, that's an amazingly low bill.
Oh, that's really low.
Yeah, so I've really gotten off easy on it.
Well, you know, now there's a great club in Deep Ellum just down the street from where you're playing tonight called Trees.
And I remember Trees. I've played there before.
Okay,
I think the first time I played in Dallas was at Trees.
One of the security doormen at Trees now has a Plum Crazy, it's not a Challenger, I think it's a Charger.
Yeah.
And have you heard of this band, this trio that does blues rock out of Toronto called Big Sugar? Have you heard of them?
I've heard the name.
I've got to get you their video. They do a song called Ride Like Hell, and it's a 74 lime green Challenger.
Yeah, well, you know, the Ugly Truth video is entirely like a Vanishing Point ripoff with my Challenger in it, too. So.
It must have been fun to make.
Yeah. And actually, the Challenger reappeared in Sick of Myself as well. Like Roman Coppola, there's that when we go to the hospital to visit Richard Lloyd playing the solo, there's some Challenger shots in there. We couldn't believe we got away with it. Like, the label didn't nix it, you know. Yeah. They'd had enough of the Challenger, you know.
How did you, you mentioned Richard Lloyd. How did you get the television guitar? How did you first meet the television guitarist?
I met Richard when I was doing a tour with the Golden Palominos in spring of 87. And Jody Harris couldn't play a couple of shows we had in New York at, what was that, the Lone Star, Lone Star Cafe, was it called? I can't remember.
Yeah.
It's no longer there, the original place where we played then. I think it's now called the Roadhouse or something where they have shows. Jody Harris couldn't make it, and Richard filled in. I was a big television fan, but I mostly knew of them in terms of Tom Verlaine. I didn't really know too much, you know, how big a part of it Richard was. and because I just kind of never focused in on that. And we just got along. You know, he also is a songwriter and does real poppy kind of songs. And I was playing some of my songs with the Palominos then, and Richard liked them. And we just kind of became friendly and kept in touch. We'd write postcards every now and then. He was out, I think, touring with John Doe after that for a while. And so, you know, ever since then, he's played on all my records. Yeah.
What there are folks listening in who think they know all about alternative music. And let us in. What would you say the importance? Why is the Marquee Moon album by Television, why is that important?
Well, it's just, first of all, it's a brilliant record musically. There's just so much amazing stuff. The guitar playing is just so unique. I mean, I think that's what really pops into my head about it. It's like no other music. You know, it's a totally unique piece of work. It's extremely creative, very poetic record. You know, all the lyrics, Tom's lyrics and everything. I think a lot of Tom's best songs are on that record. And it just really has a deep feeling in it that's amazing. And I think it came out of one that the band was in a really hot scene in New York at that time. They'd been playing live a whole lot and become really popular as a live band. And that was their first record they made. So it really captures, you know, the excitement of where they were at that time. But I think also just what really makes it so enduring is just the guitar work on it is so innovative, and the way Richard and Tom did, you know, the two guitar parts, how they interlock on that record is really amazing. But for me, it just touched me as music. It was almost like orchestral in a way, like some of the way the guitars were on it. And for me, even particularly that track, Marquee Moon, just really touched something inside of me. And in a way you can't really explain, you know, there's a vagueness about it, but there's a real feeling in there, you know, that is emotional.
Yeah. We're talking to Matthew Sweet, and we're talking about how he got Richard Lloyd, who really popped into music history as one of the two really mainstays of the band Television in the album Marquee Moon. Do you remember the year that Marquee Moon by Television came out? And mention some of the other bands that were came out of that same scene at the same time. It's amazing to look back and see what happened then and how it influenced music through now.
It's hard for me, first of all, because I'm sure when I got into Marquee Moon was very late after the fact.
I
can't remember what
77.
Year that 77 it came out.
Yeah,
so I probably didn't get into Marquee Moon till more like 80 or 81 mm-hmm. or something like that.
How did you go down to like there were some great music stores back then. In your hometown of
Lincoln,
Nebraska.
Yeah. Well, there was a place called Dirt Cheap.
Dirt
it was like
Cheap,
a combination head shop record store.
Place.
And it really was great, and those guys were so nice.
So
and
you'd go in there.
They'd play anything for us we wanted to hear before we bought it. And I would just go there and oftentimes buy things just by what they looked like, you know. Mm-hmm. Marquee Moon, though, an older friend of mine, a guy named Matt Rutledge, who I still see now and then, he lives in Baltimore now, turned me on to that record, and it really... That was a record that was really important to me. Other groups from that era that I was really into out of that kind of New York scene, well, Richard Hell and the Voidoids immediately pop into my head. And, you know, there's the two guitar players from that band have figured very prominently in my life. Robert Quine, first of all, who, you know, plays lead on Girlfriend and has been on Girlfriend, Altered Beast, and 100%. He's actually even on Earth, my second record, a little bit. And then it was through Bob that I hooked up with Ivan Julian, who's here with me today, playing lead with me on the road, who also, you know, plays on like Super Deformed and is on Altered Beast and all that. So, so Richard Hell is another spawning ground for great guitar players. You know, what other bands, you know,
Talking Head 77.
Yeah, sure. Talking Heads.
Right
yeah.
There.
We're out of that scene. Patti Smith, you know,
that's right. The horses.
There were just so many great things going on in New York at that time.
Very exciting.
And those bands really single-handedly turned me on to American music. And out of my love for them, I also got into a lot of more indie American kind of pop things, bands like the DBs and the Bongos and all that stuff out of Hoboken, Let's Active, and even, you know, the early REM. Like all of those bands I became a fan of kind of coming out of my fandom of the earlier New York scene stuff, and reading New York Rocker all the time is how I found out about, you know, like the first REM 45 that they made themselves on Hibtone.
Right.
I read about in New York Rocker and sent away for, and you know, that was a big thing in my life as well, because when I, you know, meeting them ultimately led to me, you know, moving to Athens, and that's where I got my first deal out of and everything.
It's amazing how it all happens. We're talking with Matthew Sweet live on Q102. Matthew Sweet and the band in concert tonight at Deep Ellum Live in Deep Ellum. We're going to wrap up with the song We're the Same, but I've got to ask you, you said a moment ago that you would actually go into music stores in your formative years and actually buy things based on how it looked, the artwork, the cover.
Sometimes,
of course, they were albums then, so the pictures were a little larger and the graphics were a little larger. I got to ask you about your look. Now, are you like 50% like less strong without the glasses? I mean, you know, like Hercules, you know, Samson lost his strength when he got his hair cut. Now, without, I mean, they were so much a part of your look and your image. They're history. They're gone. I mean, can you function without them?
What do you mean? Just glasses?
I loved
my horn rim glasses. I still have them.
Buddy Holly glasses.
Oh, I still have them. Those are my regular glasses. You know, I've been really into on this huge Elvis kick recently, so I've got these really Elvis glasses I've been wearing that are prescription, that are sunglasses all the time.
Okay.
And plus the back of 100% was like, it's my sunglass era, which I always hated people wearing sunglasses. So that's always the way, like I always end up doing all the things like I used to hate the most or what I'm into finally, because I get so bored of what I like, you know. It's like I used to, you know, nothing bored me more than like a 3-chord blues song, you know, 15 years ago, and then like nothing sounds good to me but a 3-chord blues song now, you know. So all those things come around. But no, I still have those glasses. I'm just not wearing them right now.
I was so afraid that possibly the whole key to your career, your talent, everything like that.
Well, they make me smarter, that's for sure. I need those glasses just to watch TV or see anything far away, but we're close enough to each other that I can see you right now.
It'll be 100% fun, guaranteed, tonight. Matthew Sweet at Deep Ellum Live. Thanks for coming by.
Sure, thanks for having me.
Q102.